Cars, start your engines!
Hit the pace car! What for? Because you hit every other damn thing out there, I want you to be perfect!
When I'm driving, I got a guy on the radio who talks to me. You can see him. He talks to me.
He didn't slam you, he didn't bump you, he didn't nudge you, he rubbed you. And rubbing's son is racing.
Good evening, race fans. Welcome to the Hoobazoo Radio Network, and welcome to Drafting the Circuits. My name is Frank Santoroski. I'll be your host for the next hour as we talk over everything race. Joining me on the panel tonight are Gray Warren and Seth Eggert. How you doing tonight, fellas?
Doing well.
Just fine, man. Glad to be here.
Yep, glad to talk to you guys. Like I say, it's the highlight of my week. So let's real quick knock out the headlines, and we've got a special guest waiting in the wings that I'm very excited about. So, but quickly, Formula One, fifth race of the season, fifth 1-2 finish for Mercedes. Not much has changed there. Conversely, both NASCAR and IndyCar put on pretty good shows this week. We saw Brad Keselowski sneak in a last-minute overtime win in Kansas. And we saw Simon Pagenaud teach a clinic on racing in the wet at the IndyCar Grand Prix, where he went from sixth place to first place in the last six laps of the race. So much more on that later. But like I said, we have a special guest. Now, we've had a number of interesting guests on the show. We've had a bunch of race car drivers. We've had crew chiefs. We've had mechanics. We've had journalists. We've had authors. This is the first for us, though. Our guest tonight is a filmmaker. Her name is Jenna Ricker. She is the director of the new ESPN 30 for 30 documentary entitled Qualified, that follows the story of Janet Guthrie. Prior to doing that, she's done such films as Ben's Plan and The American Side. And she's won some festival awards, and I'm just thrilled to have her on the line with us. Jenna, how are you tonight?
I'm doing great, Frank. I'm really excited to be here. Thanks for having me.
Oh no, thank you. Now, my first question is, did you have any, you know, passion or love of auto racing at all before you took on this project? And then my follow-up question is how was it that you became attached to this project? And, you know, was it something that was sort of your brainchild, or were you brought in?
Great questions. So, you know, I grew up with my dad, you know, tuning the radio to the Indy broadcast as a kid. But to be honest, it was just something that my dad did. And we watched the, you know, tape delayed later on at nighttime. And, you know, there was AJ Foyt and Rutherford and all those guys from the 70s and 80s that I knew of peripherally. So I was not really a race fan. And then about 10 years ago, I got asked to attend my first Indy 500. And I was a little skeptical. I thought it's going to be hot. 500 miles is a long time. I love sports, but do I really want to do this? And I was told I wouldn't be disappointed, and I wasn't. I instantly fell in love with the Indianapolis 500 in general, you know, or specifically rather. But then just all of the dynamics that go along with motorsports, and it was just fascinating to me. And I was so overwhelmed with the epic nature of the event itself at Indy. And then I started, you know, tapping into NASCAR, tapping into Formula One. Now, I'm definitely not an expert, but I enjoy it. And I enjoy the massive amounts of unknown quantity that goes with the sport that I just find fascinating. So that's me in motorsports. But Janet's story about 3 years ago, I was on doing the road trip to Indy. I live in New York City. We were doing the road trip to Indy that we do every year. And it occurred to me that I didn't know who the first woman was. I knew there was a woman in the 80s, which is Lynn St. James, but I couldn't recall her name. And I definitely knew it wasn't the contemporaries like Sarah Fisher, Danica Patrick. So I asked Greg Stewart, who is my co-producer with a lot of projects, and in fact worked on this documentary as well. And he's the one who brought me to Indy. And I said, who was the first? And he immediately said, Janet Guthrie, 1977. I looked her up. I got a hold of her autobiography. It's an amazing read. And I called her up and surprised her and asked her if she'd be willing to talk with me about doing this documentary. Went out to Aspen, Colorado, where she lives, sat with her for a couple days, and then pulled together a pitch and came to ESPN with it and said, hey, listen, we think we have a really good story here and a really specific angle that, that goes beyond her just being the first, but talks about what might have been if she'd had the right equipment and had the right sponsorship, what might have been if she'd started younger, you know, just sort of opened up the story a little bit more than just what we'd sort of seen in little promos here and there over the years, you know, around Janet. So that is how the project came to be.
That's really neat to know that this whole project is your baby. That's really cool. And you've got to see the whole thing from start to finish.
Yeah.
Now, my next question for you is, now the prior films you've made are narrative drama, and some of them low budget, you know, some of them a little more, but now you've got a studio funded project and it's a documentary style, which is a little different because you're combining your interview segments with archival footage and whatnot. So as a film director, how did you kind of have to change your approach to assemble the documentary style of film?
My stuff was narrative. You know, I wrote and directed them. This was, you know, what you have to change is how it comes together in the edit. When you write a script, you shoot the script, you know what you've got, and you know how you're going to either save things, lose things, maneuver things, etc. With something like this, I knew the bones of the story that I wanted to tell, and I knew so many aspects of her life, but it would depend on how the interviews went and what the interviews gave us to work with. And then one of my big goals before we even began was to see how much of the film we could tell archivally. And it wasn't until maybe a couple months in that we realized we were going to be able to do that, which was really, really exciting. And part of the reason I wanted to tell so much of it archivally, which, you know, essentially the whole film's archival except for the contemporary interviews, is because I didn't know who Janet Guthrie was. And I know I'm not alone in that. And I felt like when I started to see all this archive and see how much she was in the news and in the newspaper all the time, that I felt like that was a really great way to reintroduce her to audiences. All of a sudden, they're thinking consciously or subconsciously, oh my God, there's Janet Guthrie is everywhere in the late 70s. And I thought that that would be a valuable way to experience her story as she experienced it in as much as you could with quote unquote real time, you know, with the archive. So that was the approach. But I have to say, like I said, the challenges for me from coming from a narrative to the documentary were more about shaping those story points I hoped we would find and indeed did find in the edit versus knowing you have them going into the edit, which is what you do with the narrative. So it was kind of a search and rescue mission in a way.
Yeah, so I take it you were very involved in the process of looking through the archival footage and just decide what would go in the film and what would not.
Yeah. Very much so. I mean, we were looking at archives.
My favorite was the old Texaco commercials. I thought those were really cool. It brought back memories of when you had to punch a hole on top of your oil can. But go on.
No, it's true. The Havilland commercials were hilarious. It was a joyous discovery. Like we knew we had a lot of stuff between ABC and NBC in terms of race coverage. But then when we discovered, I was in Aspen with another one of our producers, Nina Christick. She and I went out there to do a little bit of an archive reconnaissance in Janet's personal archives. And Janet had all these Super 8s from her road racing days. And then her brother had all these Super 8s from her Indy days. And it was like a gold mine to find that stuff. And, you know, there's a moment in the 78 race, I shouldn't give anything away. So there's a moment in the 78 race where something, you know, drastic happens to Janet just before the race begins. And when we saw archive of that sitting with Janet in her home, I knew we were good to go to tell the story archivally. And it was a pretty great moment.
Yeah, so I can assume that most of these, the you know, so-called home movies from Janet there, these will be seen by the public for the first time, correct?
Absolutely. There's a ton of never-before-seen footage. That includes her archive, some of the photographs and imagery that we were able to get a hold of. And, yeah, it's pretty great.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, you've got a number of really big names in here that you've interviewed. I mean, AJ Foyt's in the film. We see Johnny Rutherford, Linda Vaughn, Donald Davison helped you out, Jim Lindholm, Dick Simon. But it didn't, you know, go past me that her two biggest vocal critics of the day, being Bobby Unser and Richard Petty, appear archivally, but they're not part of the interview segment. Is there anybody that you reached out to put in the film that either declined or was unavailable or was just by design?
No, it wasn't necessarily by design. To be honest, in terms of Richard Petty, we just didn't know how much NASCAR we were going to be able to cover going into the film. You know, this is the first film I've done that's going to broadcast, and there's very specific time limits on that. So we had to really shape the story around, you know, you wanted to talk about that amazing run she had in NASCAR, but we weren't going to be able to give it the kind of depth comparatively to the Indy runs that she had, you know? So we kind of knew that going in. So Richard Petty was somebody that we felt like if we could have him live in archive, that might be able to at least give us the flavor of that experience for her and her experience with him. With Bobby, we did want to interview him, and at first he declined. Then I came home one day to a wonderful voice message on my answering machine that I haven't erased from Bobby. And he and I spoke at length, and, you know, it became a creative decision because he's such a, you know, such a character and he's such a great racer. But, you know, his viewpoint seemed to, I don't want to take anything away from his viewpoint on Janet, but it didn't seem to have, not so much that it hadn't evolved. It's just that as we spoke, the drum that kept getting beat was, you know, she didn't belong there because she was a woman. And I just sort of felt like if that was what we're going to go to Albuquerque and hear, we already had that in archive, you know? So I sort of felt like, I don't know. Now, you know, he's such a character and he's so fascinating, and it could very well be that there was more depth there. But as I said, like at some point you have to make budget choices and you have to decide what you think, you know, you might be able to gain from an interview to add another spectrum or another color to the whole story. And at some point, as we got closer to having to lock the picture, I think we all sort of decided it was better just have Bobby live in archive.
Yeah, I probably agree with that because I've had several conversation with Bobby Unser, and he's better in archive, but he is, like you said, he's an interesting character, but we had him on our show actually, and all he could say is that nobody would care to watch races these days because they don't want to worship a computer, they appreciate the driver. So that's Bobby Unser for you. So,
and Bobby's now, old school, and
yes,
his,
very old
his,
school, yeah,
yeah. And you know, he comes from a time when racing was a male dominated, rough and tumble atmosphere, and basically a lot of those you know, attitudes come from those days, and you can, you know, put a lot of guys in that thing. It's so much different today than it was back then. You know, the attitudes and the openness are a little more the sport is basically more open to it than it was back in the day.
Yeah, and you know, he didn't have a wrong stance insofar as his big concern was that she was making a leap from the sports cars to the open wheel cars, and she was only doing that, she was only getting that opportunity because she was a woman. Now, she was making that leap, and it was a big leap, and to her credit, I think she proved she could do it. But I could understand the argument of like, hey, it's not fair that she's just leaping into this sport. But he couldn't get past at some point, no matter what she did, right, that she was a woman. And as she says in the film at one point, you know, if I got this opportunity because I was a woman, there were so many more opportunities I didn't get because I was a woman, which is very true.
And part of that goes back to that old school attitude where you had to, whether you were a male or female, in those days, you had to earn and gain the respect of men like Mario Andretti and Bobby Unser and Al Unser and A.J. Foyt, because these were tough-minded guys. And they understood people that understood them and raced with them. And that respect came from success. You know, they respected their peers that shared the same success that they did to a certain degree and a certain level. And I think a lot of it, you know, that's why they kind of looked down on Janet to some degree, because she, you know, she didn't share their success, and I'm talking about wins and things like that. But, you know, the thing that to me that impressed me about Janet was, and I'll say it like this. The late Fireball Roberts said many, many, many years ago, the greatest compliment you can pay someone in our sport is to refer to them as a racer. And that the term racer goes to the struggle, the sacrifice, determination that people in our sport share, whether you are a driver, a mechanic, or an owner, or whatnot. Just that determination to succeed in the sport, to get into it and to survive in it. And you know, that's still common today. I mean, do you refer to one of your peers in the sport as a racer? It's a compliment, you know, to his character in our sport. And that's what, you know, Janet was a racer because she made the sacrifice and she made she did it her way. She came up and did the stuff that grassroots racers do to get to the next level. And I don't care whether you're male or female. You have to respect and admire those qualities in someone that is following their dream and following their passion.
Yeah, I'm so glad you bring that up, because that is one of the things for me, you know, having finished her book and then started the massive amount of research on the other drivers and that era of racing, you know, and the sort of, you know, innovations that were still happening and the sacrifices and the deaths, you know, and the, I mean, it was and is a sport that really requires everything of you, both before you're on the track and then when you're on the track. And I just I do feel like Janet really did for where she could. There was no way she was going to get in there any other way than the way she did, frankly, right? In 1976, they're not combing any circuits to get women into open wheel racing at all. So once you step aside from like how she got in there, she hadn't sort of done the sprint car work your way up aspect, but when she got there and proved she could stay there, I mean, this is a woman who gave up a career in aeronautical engineering, who went broke building her own engines to race in these road races, and just did everything she could do to make it as a professional racer. And when that opportunity comes, I don't care who you are as a racer or a driver, if someone comes to you and says, listen, if you want to drive this car and we can make this car go, do you want to take a shot at this? I don't know who would say no to that, you know, if they're a racer, right?
So
I just, her tenacity and her single-mindedness was just so admirable. And to be honest, as a female director, I had a lot of my own kind of kinship to her experience, insofar as, you know, to make a movie, you can't do it on your own. You need somebody to back you financially, you know, you like a sponsor. You need a team that comes together that helps you get the film up and running and across the finish line. And I just had so much, it was odd to me and kind of funny that I started to find myself relating in my own experiences as a filmmaker to what she was doing as a race car driver. Obviously, not life and death.
but because you faced the same barriers, a lot of the same barriers you had to overcome to you know, make your way in your chosen field. Yeah, I can understand that.
Yeah, you know, there's a couple of, there's another producer, there's four producers on this that were just an awesome, awesome team to work with. Myself, a woman named Caroline Waterloo, who was the producer for the OJ Made in America doc, ESPN's, I think it was a 6-8-part series about OJ, Nina Kristic, and Greg Stewart. And this was just such an awesome, vibrant team. And we all, especially the, you know, Nina and Caroline and I, we all, you know, had those moments where the eyes in the room shift to the, whoever the man is with you, when you're the one who's in charge of a project, you know, and this, we're getting somewhere, but those moments still happen. And so again, yeah, like you said, I could really, I had moments where I was like, oh boy, Janet, I 40 years later, and I know that feeling.
Now, Seth, I want to bring you into the conversation because I know you've got a couple of questions or comments.
Yes, I do. As you said, Janet Guthrie wasn't always in the best equipment. Sometimes she wasn't even given the best equipment. What do you believe are some of the important lessons or takeaways from her story?
That's God, Seth. That's a good one. I mean, on the one hand, I think one of the takeaways in a more aspirational way is if you want to do something, you find a way to do it. And that's, you know what I mean? Like and that's her inspirational side. In the sort of technical side as a racer, you know, I asked her if she ever regretted saying no to Pat Patrick, for example, who did ask her to leave Rolla and join his team. And she said she never once regretted it. And I think she knew as a racer, perhaps at 39 at the time, I think she was 39, 1 year into a full year of racing. And, you know, the other drivers that Pat Patrick had, these were guys he had put a lot of time and money behind. She may have been left behind, you know, he may have given her like one ride and then taken it all away. And I think she wasn't sure how that would have gone, I should say, you know. And so when it comes to the equipment and the opportunity, God, I don't know what the takeaway is other than what she did was to try to get the most out of her cars. And she really did do that statistically comparative to the drivers who had had the cars before her or after her. So she did have a talent for making, you know, shit boxes, as they like to call them, fly. Now, she was a mechanic, you know, she was building her own engine, so it might have had something to do with that. I know that when I spoke with Phil Casey, amazing mechanic, and Kenny Ozawa and Jim Lindholm, all of her, you know, chief mechanics, they all said that she had this ridiculous knack to hear and feel things that, you know, you almost couldn't believe her. And then they take this, they take it back to the shop and they'd be like, damn it, she was right. That is, there is something going on here. So she, and I think that had to do with, you know, her building her own engine. So I guess the takeaway was, is if you're going to have to deal with some bad equipment, learn to know it and love it and see what you can get out of it. I mean, today too, the cars and chassis and the setups aren't as different as they were back then. So, you know, there's something to that too.
And just being the NASCAR guy on this podcast, no offense, Gray, but I remember a story from when she ran the 600, which you do mention a little bit, not to give too much away from the doc, but the story goes she was slow in practice, and one of the teams that had been helping her effort out, in part because of Humpy Wheeler, the track promoter, was Junior Johnson's team. And he went over to her and asked her if she had really gone that slow, if she could really do this. When she said yes, he put Cale Yarborough in her car, and he went 3 miles per hour slower than her.
Yeah.
And he looked at the crew chief, and his only comment was, give her the damn setup.
Yep.
And he walked off. And in that race, I actually looked at the stats. She beat a number of NASCAR Hall of Famers, including Bill Elliott, who lost an engine, I think, 20 laps ago, 30 laps ago, something like that. So it's impressive nonetheless. And where she had a lot of criticism and was under a microscope throughout her entire career, do you think women, at least today, are getting a fair shake in motorsports?
You know, I don't know that it's necessarily an equal shake, is the best way to put it. Like, if you, to win, you have to race. To race, you have to have the sponsorship and the setups and all that stuff and the team. And so if you're going to progress and be competitive, you have to run more races. And I think what's happening still, to some extent, I mean, Danica was an exception, I think, is that what's happening still is that a lot of women are getting one or two shots, you know, only the big ones or only the marquee names. Well, you know, it's going to be hard to carve out a real presence that moves the needle enough that a young woman coming up somewhere in this, you know, sprint tracks or go-kart says, hey, I know I can do it because so-and-so is doing it, you know? And I think subconsciously and consciously, that's what we all do as young people with dreams. We find people that look like us or have, you know, goals like us, and we emulate them. So if you're a young racer, a young woman, and you have only a handful of people that only pop up every once in a while, it can feel really like, well, I don't know if that's the way, if that's what I want to do. It doesn't seem to be working, you know? So I guess that's a long way to answer the question that I think fans and ideally racers themselves are much more open to it than they were in 76 when Janet shows up. But I still think we have a long way to go to make it a viable reality for young women to pursue it as a goal. I remember as a little girl, I loved playing soccer, and I was in the car with my dad, and we were driving by Angel Stadium. I grew up in Southern California, and we were driving by Angel Stadium, and there was a soccer match going on. And I got so excited, and I said to my dad, I'm going to do that when I grow up. And he said to me, oh, I'm sorry, sweetheart, they don't have women's soccer. And at the time they didn't, you know? And so I always think about that moment. It was like the first moment for me, I found out I couldn't do something because I was a girl or a woman, you know? And so I guess that we still have to move the needle on bringing women into the sport and finding a way to keep them there. And I totally understand that it is an expensive sport and it is hard for everybody to get sponsorship, you know, but I think you have to have more women and more races who can then win and have an honest shot at winning before, you know, we can sort of say that we've turned a massive corner on it.
And, yeah. Oh, go ahead, Seth. I'm sorry.
This is my last one. There's another NASCAR story at Bristol one time. Janet Guthrie was suffering, I want to say, from the flu. And mid-race, Ricky Rudd had gotten in her car as a relief driver. And he said he could not believe the same people who were pulling over for him earlier were now fighting almost like to the death with him because they thought it was still Janet in the car.
Yep.
And he actually booted one out of the way who gave him a certain gesture thinking it was Janet, and post-race went looking for Janet, not knowing that Janet was sick and had left the track at that point. So I'm just curious, how much differently do you think Janet on track was raced compared, not let alone the criticism she got off track?
Yeah, unfortunately, I think that was not an uncommon story. Ricky Rudd's story is not uncommon to her experience. I know that there was in 78 when she was racing the Texaco Star, you know, with the team she funded and built herself, basically, with a month to go to the race, which is just insanity. But when she was doing that, George Bignotti was helping out a lot with the team. And at one point, Gordon Johncock got in the car to shake it down, and he came back and he was furious. He like threw his helmet. He was furious because he was being treated similar to Ricky Rudd. And he sort of, it was his first awareness that like, holy crap, this is what you're dealing with out there, Janet, you know? And so I think, I don't think it was uncommon. And it's really scary because we know how dangerous the sport is on a good day. But to have that, to be having to face that down when you race every time, you know, there were slower cars that want to get out of the way when she would race. I mean, it just, it's that thing where, like, you know, there's racing and there's being a rookie, and then there's what Janet had to deal with, which was a whole other level.
Right, and it comes back around full circle to the attitudes that guys like Bobby Unser and some of those guys had, you know, and it's a respect thing, you know, in their eyes, and that's why they get, that's why they raced her a certain way, and it goes on today. I mean, it, you know, even you know, whether you're male or female, you have to earn the respect of the so-called hot dogs, you know, in the sport.
Yeah. Well, you know what's interesting though is that, you know, the AJ Foyt, for example. I mean, I don't think you get any more bravado than AJ. You know, and he felt very much like, you know, the racer, the competitor that is AJ looked at her as just another competitor. If she can do it, great. It's one more person for me to beat. Right. And I just so admired that mindset. And I know he was somewhat in the minority with that in terms of those top racers. But, you know, a lot of the guys did come around. It's just that we're lucky Janet didn't get into some horrific accident in the meantime, you know, but they did come around. I think Bobby, you know, Petty may have come around for all I know, but
I know guys like Darrell Waltrip and some of those guys came around and she earned their respect and their admiration for what she did. But, you know, it goes on, it goes on back in the pack. You know, there's a lot of guys out there that week in and week out are racing, you know, for their livelihood and race from 15th to 30th back into pack. And those guys race tooth and nail for everything they can get. And, you know, you throw someone in like in there like that, you know, they are going to have less respect for her than, say, the upper echelon in the sport.
Right. I see. Yeah, no, I see what you're saying. It's true. She was going to be in that pack, you know, to your point. She was going to be in that, you know, front of the middle is kind of where she always landed. She seemed to often land in, like, you know, 13th, 14th qualifying position, at least at Indy. And NASCAR, she qualified much higher at times. But I agree with you. Yeah, I think that then you're talking about these guys trying to fight for position, and here she is, and what are we going to do with this now?
Right. Exactly.
I mean, it's bittersweet because there's the part of me that totally understands that. And then there's a part of me that feels like, but for what, at what moment did it change for you guys when you saw that she wasn't endangering your lives? She could do, she could race, she could compete. And that's, once I switch over to that side, I start to be annoyed with the ones that couldn't get on with it.
And she made it, she gave a good account of herself every time she got in the car. She wasn't in the way. She was competitive. She got out there and she gave everything she could and got the most out of the equipment that she did. And she, I think a lot of times, she beat a lot of guys. And I think that, you know, was another thing she had to overcome as well.
Yeah, that's true. You know, the other thing that I had done at one moment, and I, you know, forgive me, I'm not going to be able to, you know, pull the stats correctly, but at one point I just wanted to see, you know, Janet had her second Indy, she finishes in the top 10 in an Indy car that she's driving for the first time that year, that whole season, you know? And I thought, well, how did some of these other racers that, you know, roll off our tongues, these champions, how did they fare in their second Indy? How long did it take them to finish in the top 10? And it was really interesting. You know, Rutherford and some of these other guys, they were many more races, many more Indies and full seasons of Indy cars before they finished anywhere in the top 10. And I just thought that was, you know, racing is such as detailed sport. It's not just like the fastest, you know, there's so many components, but I just thought that was so interesting.
And each competitor has a rite of passage that they have to go through to ascend, you know, in the sport as well.
Yeah. Yeah. So pretty interesting stuff. I love the fact that racing isn't just as simple.
Well, go ahead, Jenna.
Yes.
No, I would just we're just running up against our time limit for the segment. So we're having a great conversation here, but I really want to thank you for coming on the show. The film is called Qualified. It's going to premiere on May 28th on ESPN networks, and then there'll be a number of other broadcasts of that as well on ESPN. They'll show it on ESPN2 and you and that. So do you have any other screenings or events planned for the month of May in the Indianapolis area as you've been doing?
You know what? At the moment, no. Janet's coming to New York at the beginning of next week, and we'll be, you know, going around and talking about the film. But at the moment, I don't know if I'll get back to Indy before actually coming for the race. So everyone should definitely mark their calendars for May 28th, 8 p.m. ESPN, and then check it on out from there.
Look forward to it.
Yeah.
Thank you, guys.
Now, where can folks find you on social media, find more information about the film? Are there any other sponsors you need to plug, as I tell all my race car driver guests?
Well, they probably go on and on with the sponsor list.
Yeah.
Well, I want to thank, you know, and put a shout out to my awesome team, Caroline Waterlow, Nina Christic, Greg Stewart, and then the folks at ESPN that believed in this project and got behind it. It's been an awesome ride. At this time last year, we were heading out to Indy to start doing our interviews with everybody. So it's been a good, long, happy, profitable year. So on social media, I mean, you can follow me, you know, you can find me just by my name. Then I have a website for another film that you can look at too for the American side. But in terms of ESPN and Qualified, their website, ESPN 30 for 30 Films, you can track us down there and then see the movie.
All right, well, that sounds great. And my other plan is to watch the American side, because I'd read the description of the film. Where there's a detective trying to hunt down a missing Tesla device. I think this is right up my alley. I like an interesting film like that. So
yeah, I'm looking forward
to watching that.
Well, yeah, you can feel free to call me if you need any plot insider things, because it's noir. It's pretty dense and pretty twisty.
Yes.
So
here it's very complex. That's my kind of movie. I'm looking forward to that. So
awesome.
But thank you again for coming on the show, and we will. We will be following up with you on social media. Again, May 28th, the film is called Qualified. You'll find it on ESPN. So best of luck to you, Jenna, and we hope to talk to you again soon.
All right. Thank you guys so much. Enjoy the rest of the chat, and I'll see you at Indy.
Yes, I'll see you at Indy. I'll be there. Thank you.
All right. Take care. Bye-bye.
Thank you.
Thank you.
All right, fellas. So Kansas NASCAR.
Kansas NASCAR.
Which one of you guys wants to jump in? We've got about 20 minutes left in the show. We could do 10 minutes NASCAR, 10 minutes IndyCar. Because, like I said, Formula One, you know, another Mercedes one, too. What could be said? But I thought the NASCAR race was pretty good.
Probably the best mile and a half race we've had this year. I thought it was a terrific race. We got what we wanted. We got a lot of movement throughout the race. It's very highly competitive. A lot of guys ran up front. I really enjoyed it. I thought it was a good race. Had a great ending. Keselowski comes through, and of course Harvick, he dominated. He led the most laps, but he never did completely, you know, get away from everybody. But racing all up and down through the field was terrific. They were running three and four abreast a lot during the race. And, you know, if you want side-by-side racing, that race delivered.
And they were even five wide at times.
Yep.
And I don't mean just on the restart. I mean for like two, three, four laps in a row, which at least for 1.5 miles, unusual in most cases.
And it kept the field closely bunched up together. I mean, you didn't see guys getting away. So I thought the rules package probably, you know, did what it was intended to do there. And I for one, looking forward to the All-Star race this weekend.
Now, just a couple of different notes that I had. This is actually the first time since Pocono 2015 And no one of the big three that we've been talking about all last year anyway did not finish in the top 10.
Mm-hmm.
Harvick was the best of that big three contingent, finishing 13th, and he actually had to go to pit road. He thought he had a right front going down. What it actually was a windshield tear off on the splitter, made the car act like it had a tire going down.
And Kyle Busch, he had trouble there on one of the restarts. He got kind of sandwiched and pinched down and ended up having a tire issue, because I think basically he was headed to another top 10 finish, possibly a top 5 finish before his trouble got him.
One other thing, NASCAR admitted that they actually did make a mistake on one of those final restarts, that they had Eric Jones restarting 8th, or in the 8th position. He should have restarted actually in 10th. Does that make that big of a difference in the long run? We probably won't know. But there were a lot of drivers moving up and down, trying to protest where they were supposed to restart because the caution had come out in the middle of a round of green flag pit stops.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of the fans were complaining on Twitter, on Facebook, you know, social media, you name it. And the ultimate reason is because the drivers were being told we should restart here. But NASCAR's system is all electronic. They should have known exactly where everybody should have started. And they were telling the drivers, but they kept moving up. But Eric Jones' team, for example, were arguing that because they didn't pit, they should have been the leader because they were on the lead lap.
Mm-hmm.
However, they took the wave around. And they know they took the wave around. So it was those shenanigans that cost us probably somewhere around 4 or 5 laps of green flag competition. Ultimately, that's on the teams. That's not on NASCAR. It's just all the fans, of course, blame NASCAR because to them, they don't see or hear the team's shenanigans. One other thing I do want to mention also, Tyler Reddick, in his second Cup start, got a top 10 finish, which nowadays is pretty unheard of. 11 teams failed pre-race inspection, and with this being an impound race, that meant they all lost their starting position. Not only does this affect them this past weekend at Kansas, it'll also affect them in 2 weeks at the Coke 600, because qualifying, the order that they go out is a random draw. The first 20 that go out is everyone who started in the second half of the field the previous week. So that would be drivers like Chase Elliott, Eric Almirola, Martin Truex Jr., etc.
So is that a disadvantage to go out in the first half of the session?
Depending on the track, at Charlotte, with how temperature sensitive it is, qualifying starts during the day but ends at night.
So you're gonna get it. You're gonna get a better speed after the sun goes down.
Yes.
Understood.
So it really depends on the track. Ultimately, the Truck Series was also in action. Ross Chastain got his first career truck win after Stuart Friesen ran out of fuel. It's also the first truck win for Nice Motorsports, which only became a team less than 2.5 years ago.
Good for them.
Al Nice, who's a war veteran, joked that he started a team for him to race. Mind you, he's 70 years old. And that he originally wanted to call it IR Racing because he actually took money from his IRA account to start the team.
That's funny. Yeah, so good for them. So we are off to the All-Star Race next.
Yes.
And do we have a new format this year, or are we?
It's the same format as last year, except the final stage is an extra 5 laps.
And any tweaks in the rules package for this weekend, Seth?
Well, we have the extra long splitter, and when I say extra long, I don't mean extending forward. It's basically a giant radiator pan that's supposed to eliminate some of the shenanigans teams are doing underneath the car that we don't see. We also have the air ducts going up through the hoods, which makes them look a little bit more like the actual street cars. And those parts and pieces are all manufactured by NASCAR. And the teams did not get these pieces until Friday of last week. So that way they could not go to the wind tunnel and try to maximize performance.
Because they have kind of an equalizing effect, getting everybody the stuff at the last minute, huh?
That, and also it gives NASCAR a more accurate gauge as to where to go, because this kind of stuff is being tested for the 2021 rules package, essentially the Gen 7 car. But depending on the results this weekend, we could see one, if not both of these in next year's rules package.
Just have to see how it looks on the track. Now, the to be in the All-Star race, right? Now, that includes all past champions, correct?
Within the past 10 years.
Do we have anybody that's been a champion 10 years ago that's still around?
Other than Jimmy Johnson?
Jimmy Johnson, yeah. I think he won all those, right? So,
Now.
Yeah, 10 years is not that long of a time frame now that I think about it. Past race winners from the last year?
2018 and 2019.
Okay. And then we have the Open, right?
Each stage winner from the Open, that's three total. And the fan
vote. And a fan vote. Okay. So now the fan vote, that's already active and going on, is it not?
Yes. Last I checked, Matt DiBenedetto is actually leading the fan vote. They don't give us actual numbers to see, but he was in the lead. And Ross Chastain, who, like I said, won the truck race this past weekend, he's an Xfinity Series regular. He's actually in the top 10 for the drivers eligible for the fan vote.
Now, if he wins the fan vote and doesn't have a cup ride,
Does somebody
put him in a car? He is entered.
He's entered. He is running the full season with Premium Motorsports.
Okay.
The only the eligibility requirements for the Open and for the fan vote is that you have to have competed within the past 2 years. And you also have to finish the Open on the lead lap with an undamaged car.
So what's the definition of undamaged? I mean, does it need to be pristine clean? I mean, is a little fender bumping okay?
A little fender bumping is okay. Basically, it will not need to go through the damaged vehicle policy that NASCAR has.
All right. Yeah, that's kind of an interesting wrinkle there, because we've seen guys, you know, win a race in the Cup Series in a car that's largely, you know, beat to heck, especially on a short track. You know, not so much at Charlotte. But
the problem is, though, the Open is only about an hour and a half, 2 hours before the race, before the All-Star race. So if you finish with a damaged car, and when I say damaged, I'm talking about the entire front end being ripped off because he went through the grass and dug into the grass or something, or you have suspension damage because you bounce off the wall, you would not have enough time in normal circumstances to repair it. Basically, yeah, they don't want anyone pulling out a backup car.
I got you. That makes sense then, since the next race is right after that. So do we want to pick a winner for the All-Star race? I mean, I know it's all for fun, it's all for money, but who do you like for this one, Gray?
Oh gosh, it's hard to say, but I don't know. I'm going to go with a Ford. They've been tough all year long. I'm going to say Joey Logano.
Sure, good pick. Now, Seth, you going to go with a Chevy then?
I'm going to go with Chevy, yes.
And see, I read your mind.
I'm actually going to go with Jimmy Johnson. The reason why I'm thinking Jimmy, although it wouldn't be his first win this year, I believe he's either he or Kevin Harvick are the last ones to actually sweep both of the non-points races in a season, which is the Clash and the All-Star race. But with the performance Hendrick has had recently, I mean, seven Chevys in the top 10 at Kansas, on top of the fact that Jimmy is just due for a win. If he doesn't win by the 600, he's going on a two-year winless streak.
Wouldn't that be just great if he breaks his 2-year winless streak in a non-points race?
How I mean, ironic
like,
that would be.
That's like a Pyrrhic victory, right? Or a backhanded compliment or whatever you'd like to call it. So, well, since Gray, you're going to go with a Ford, and Seth, you're going to go with a Chevy, I'm going to go with a Toyota and say that Martin Truex Jr., the master of the 1.5 mile ovals, go ahead and going to win the All-Star race here. So but with that being said, let's focus on Indianapolis. It's the month of May. The IndyCar Grand Prix was held recently. As I alluded to earlier, Simon Pagenaud, who's, you know, in a lot of folks' minds, Simon's been on the hot seat at Penske. They're talking like, you know, that he may be replaced by Rossi, this and that. And this is all idle talk, you know, not from informed sources. But Simon came out and put on a clinic. I mean, my gosh, he didn't qualify well. But once the rain came, he really got around that course better than anybody else. And he was running seconds quicker than everybody else and just ran through that field at the end. Great.
The last 10 laps were great.
Yeah, it was fantastic. And the race itself was full of action of different varieties. You know, we saw a very interesting starting grid there with Rosenqvist taking his first pole. Jack Harvey qualified third. Jack Harvey finished third, his career best start and finish. And that Michael Shank team, they're just happy as can be. The momentum they have going into the Indianapolis is fantastic. I mean, Jack Harvey was very composed, you know, rarely put a wheel wrong all race, and you know, and reaped the benefits of that. So great job to Jack Harvey. So with the Grand Prix behind us, and again, that's the was the fifth race of the IndyCar season and the fifth different winner, which I think is always a good way to start the season. It shows how deep the field is. Now the practice for the Indianapolis 500 is underway. We've got 2 days of practice under our belts. Both days were led by the Penske cars. Will Power led day one. Joseph Newgarden led day two. And both in the 228, 229 range. But the interesting thing to look at is the no toe speeds. And you've got to look at who's there. You've got folks that are near the bottom of the speed charts, but the no toe speeds, they're much higher up. Like, say Pippa Mann, for instance, you've got the, she's kind of mired towards the back there, but her no toe speed is 12th quick. And the no toe speed is more indicative of what you're going to see in a qualifying effort. So, but the big news is the first guy to find the wall, was Alonso. Now, day one of practice, McLaren struggled mightily, could not get the car up to speed. Day two, they got a little more speed. He cracked into the top 20 in speeds there, you know, which would be very, very safe for qualifying. And he lost it. He hit the inside wall and the outside wall twice. So he joined the old saying goes, there's two kind of drivers at Indianapolis, those that have hit the wall and those that are going to hit the wall. So he joined that club. And later in the afternoon, Felix Rosenqvist joined that club as well. He had a nasty hit into the outside wall and then into the tire barriers. Took a real hard hit.
Both Will Power and Jack Harvey are lucky they didn't clobber him as he went back across the track out of control, obviously.
Right,
but
right. He nearly collected both of those guys there. It could have been a three-car wreck. But, you know, thankfully, Will and Jack made it through. Felix, so now, you know, we've seen how the car can just get away from you at Indianapolis. We've seen it with much greater. We've seen it happen to the great Rick Mears. You know, late in his career, he had never hit the wall. And then 92, he's ended up upside down sliding down the backstretch during a practice run. So I feel like at the end of the day, all the cars were, I believe, 0.8 seconds separated the entire field. But it's a little early to tell who's going to be in real trouble of being in this last road shootout. By the time the show airs, the day three will be done, and then a Friday will be Fast Friday. Saturday will begin the qualifying procedure. So looking forward to a really good Indy 500. Other news out of Indy, Junco showed up with the news that they had lost both their sponsors for the Indy 500. So Kyle Kaiser is there running very competitive times in a plain white car. I mean, it looks like the diecast of the autograph car, just plain white, sad looking, you know, space for rent here. So, but the way they're running, I hope somebody jumps on board. You know, we've seen Indianapolis through the month of May is known for these sponsor announcements. As a matter of fact, you know, Harding Steinbrenner announced three new sponsors for their car. You know, one primary and two associates. They announced two more associates today. So there's folks out there looking to attach their name to a race car. So hopefully Kyle can run well enough that he'll catch somebody's eye and they'll want to attach their name to the car. I mean, Ricardo Juncos is a very professional operation. The guy is top notch. So hopefully, you know, somebody will step up and help them out. So now, Seth, Greg, get to watch the Grand Prix or any of the practice?
No, I have not had a chance to watch any practice this year. Of course, you know, unlike years past, now you have to purchase the package from
NBC
Sports to get, you know, the content that we were used to getting, you know, over the last several years. You used to could go to, you know, to the Speedway site or to Indy Race Control and get to watch practice. So no, but I've tried to follow it, but I haven't been able to sit and watch it like I have in years past.
Yeah, it's a little disappointing for those folks that don't have the gold, but you know, the folks that have bought that gold package, and by the way, they've dropped the price on it from I think $59 to
$39.
Yeah, what I saw. Offering a discount, so. But what I'm hearing or what I'm seeing is that we're getting really top-notch quality, you know, broadcast quality stuff on NBC Gold. Whereas the, you know, the Facebook Live stuff they would do, you just, you know, there were just some static camera angles with
the radio guys.
IMS radio, which, and then what the radio guys are talking about never matched what you were seeing on the track. So this
but
is
you know, the thing about it is, though, you know, with a sport that's trying to garner viewership, like it is and pick up their presence and ratings and whatnot, it looks like they would kind of make it a little bit more of a, have an appeal to it to where you can watch it and not have to go, because I tell you, you know, when people have to look for it, you know, you're out of sight, out of mind.
Oh yeah. I just want to say, but you know, the era of free television is nearly over as the era of streaming stuff is taking over. And there's a lot of different opinions. There's some folks that just refuse to buy the pad and think it's the worst thing in the world. And there are other folks that have bought it and think it's the greatest thing in the world. Then there's guys that have bought it and can't figure out how to work it and feel very disappointed. But Seth, you had a comment?
More recently, NASCAR is actually moved a lot of their practice sessions and some truck qualifying sessions onto their own website. And like Gray said, sometimes that stream is just stack camera angles, and you have either the folks at the Motor Racing Network or the Performance Racing Network, the two radio stations, providing the play-by-play, and sometimes it's not what you're seeing on the camera.
Yeah, and one thing that, you know, we were used to watching was, you know, the morning practices would be on the ones that the practices early afternoon or the late morning practices would always be televising. But now, what is it, FS1 is only showing practice that begin after 3 p.m. in the afternoon. Is that right, Seth?
Unless it's the Daytona 500, which obviously is past. The Coke 600, I believe, is going to be different. And I think Sonoma, because it's their last race of the season FS1.
But the interesting thing for me is that if you watch Fox Sports 1 in the morning, they show the same three talk shows six times a piece.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? You know, how many times you want to listen
but here's the deal.
Take, you know, or – So,
they've got sponsors for them, though. They've got
sponsor ads.
So, I mean, basically, that's what's driving it. So, yeah.
But I can only listen to Colin Cowherd so much, though.
Exactly.
So, anyway, with
you on that.
Yeah. So we're up against our time barrier. But what I do want to do is, you know, Indianapolis qualifying will come up. So let's all pick the pole winner for Indianapolis. So who do you think takes the pole for Indianapolis? And give me an idea of what you think that pole speed's going to be.
That's a tough one.
Well,
I'm going to go with Will Power. He was the fastest in the opening practice, if I remember correctly. And pole speed, what are they averaging? 220?
Yeah, they've been 228, 229.
Okay.
But once they crank the boost up on Friday, you'll see it go over 230.
No, yeah, no, I was going to say depending on what the weather is for this weekend, but I would, you know, I'm thinking I'm going to say
the pole speed will be 233.5.
That's a fast pole speed.
Yeah.
I'd like to see that. I mean, it's not impossible. We've seen laps over 232, 233 on Fast Friday recently. Mm-hmm. So, now, Gray, what are your thoughts?
We've had a lot of guys flirt with it. Scott Dixon was at the top of the pylon for a bit today when I checked in. I don't know. You know, it's Penske cars look tough right now. I'm gonna say Newgarden, and I'm gonna say pole speed's gonna be 232.
All right, so you stole my pick. So, but I think all the Penske cars are stout. I think the Chevrolets are stout. But for me, I'm gonna say Ed Carpenter takes his third pole at the Speedway at a speed of 232 and change. So, and maybe Ed wins one this year. Who knows? The guy had a great year last year. The only thing keeping him from winning is that Will Power had a better race.
Yeah.
With that being said, guys, we're out of time. So, by the time we reconvene next week, I'll be getting ready to pack my bags to go to Indianapolis for the race. We'll know who the pole sitter is. We'll know who won the All-Star race, and we'll have a good conversation about the Indy 500. We'll know who's in and who's out. So that'll be a great show next week. Again, I want to thank Jenna Ricker for coming on the show. Remind you again that Qualified will be on ESPN on the 28th of May. I want to thank the Hoobazoo Radio Network and Spreaker and iHeartRadio. And I want to thank you, Gray, and thank you, Seth. And we'll talk to you in a week. Good night.
Hoobazoo.com.